GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Welcome. I'm your host for GreenSense.
My name's Bob Kessler. I am your executive producer. I'm working the phones, turning the knobs.
And we together explore environmental issues, and we together learn about sustainable innovations and meet passionate people that are changing the world.
Yes, they may be passionate, but they also have to have ideas that make common and economic sense. That is how they get here on GreenSense.
And I make sure that their ideas are good for the environment. Bob, what are we talking about this week?
Well, you know, World Water Day is coming up on the 22nd, so we'll be meeting with the Pacific Institute, one of the top water conservation organizations. Also, Heroic Food. This is great. A lot of veterans are coming back from service and they need jobs. Well, Heroic Food is teaching them how to be sustainable farmers. But first, we're going to kick things off with Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News and talk indoor farms in cities.
All coming up on this week's edition of GreenSense. Growing Green on our regular segment on urban agriculture is back with Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me again.
Lots of people are looking at controlled environment agriculture. It's taking agriculture indoors using artificial light. Many of these lights are LED lights, high-pressure sodium lights, or derivatives of that. What do you know about this, Chris? And how is the price and technology of LED lights changing so that's making it more affordable?
Well, yeah, this is a topic that I actually am very interested by and surrounded by most of my day. So the LED lights, our lighting technology in general is becoming more and more efficient. And if the trend towards growing crops in more controlled environments continues, the ability to produce light using electric sources is going to become more and more important. And currently, as we all know, outdoor farms don't pay for their light energy. So efficiency of lighting technologies is greatly important if controlled environment agriculture is continuing to grow, or if we're going to be growing light-loving crops in areas or geographies that don't have a lot of light through their winter months. And we've spoken in the past about locally grown produce. For us and for consumers in northern markets to have locally grown produce year-round, the ability to provide supplemental light is extremely important. Otherwise, those plants simply won't grow in those environments.
So let's look at the different indoor growing environments and talk about how lighting is changing. So the first is the greenhouse.
Yep.
And then there's a glasshouse. Can you differentiate the two?
Yeah, so a greenhouse and a glasshouse, it's the same thing. Really, you have different levels of technology in a greenhouse. So, if the general public is just driving through, eastern part of the United States, they're going to see a lot of hoop houses. Those are very low tech greenhouses that don't have any supplemental heat, right? So they're just using solar energy to keep the crop warmer earlier in the spring or later in the fall, but they provide no heat in the winter times. Then you have traditional greenhouses, which provide heat, but their level of technology with inside the greenhouses are fairly low and they're fairly inexpensive and moderately expensive to run. Then you have high-tech greenhouses, and that's where oftentimes we use the term glass house, because glass is probably the most expensive glazing we can use in the industry, but it's also one of the most efficient glazings we can use. Those greenhouses will oftentimes have supplemental light, very intricate heating systems. So they're a highly controlled environment. So you just think in terms of technology, a greenhouse represents all of it, but there are certain names that have come up depending on what sorts of the technology one's using.
So a greenhouse is using the natural light and then there's supplemental light. Talk about the types of supplemental light and how that's changed over time.
Yeah, Well, for the most part, greenhouses are still using HPS or high pressure sodium lights, similar to the light lamps that one sees in, on most U.S. streets. So they've been using those, I would say, since the 60s and 70s. And if you do really look at history, you can find supplemental light using gas lit sources all the way back into the late 1800s. So it all depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to manage the length of the day, the light fixtures have a tendency to be lower intensity. If you're trying to add more light to the crop to increase growth, then those have a tendency to be high pressure or high output light fixtures.
And what is this lighting allowing us to do, and how does it benefit the consumer?
What the lighting's allowing us to do is to grow crops when in seasons when those crops don't naturally grow. Plants are very dependent on light, as we all know, for photosynthesis, but plants also grow and fruit and flower based on day length. So when the days are short, we're able to use light to trick the plants into thinking they're long days, which allow the plants to continue to be productive.
That's Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News with Growing Green. I'm Robert Colangelo. Remember to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher when you visit greensensefarms.com. With World Water Day coming up on March 22nd, we're going to discuss key water issues and solutions with Pacific Institute Senior Research Associate, Laura Feinstein. Laura, welcome to Green Sense.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Laura, give us the elevator pitch about your organization that best describes the Pacific Institute and why it exists.
Well, we're a global water think tank. We work on researching water issues around the world.
What's your mission?
Our mission is to develop sustainable solutions for water challenges facing the world. So we look into issues like how we can do more with the water that we have in ways that are more sustainable than the way we have been doing them in the past.
Can you give just a brief concrete example of a project that has been helpful and successful?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that Pacific Institute has been working on for a long time now is talking about how people can be more efficient with their water use. And during the time that Pacific Institute has been around for the last 25 years in California, we've seen the expectations for how much water people need steadily dropping and people becoming more and more efficient with how they use the waters in their home. And we think to some degree that that's due to our research and presenting information and solutions about how it is that people can use less water to do the things they need to do.
Well, as a recovering hydrogeologist, we were taught in school that we don't have a water shortage. We have a water management issue. So organizations like yours are great because it teaches us to be a lot smarter with our water. And one of the things that's a little bit worrisome to me is while the California drought has moved on, it's easy to think that we don't have to pay attention to water conservation. You know, it's out of sight, out of mind. But what other issues are most important when it comes to clean water in the U.S. and around the world?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought up the issue of the drought. I mean, it's tempting to think that that because this was a really wet year in California, that all our water management problems are over, and that's not true. Some of the big issues that we have are that, at least out here in California and in the West, we over-pump groundwater. So groundwater is basically our savings account that we tap into during dry years to get us through the droughts, and we are steadily overdrafting it. And it's not going to be there if we keep using it in the way that we're using it right now. So that's a long-term problem we need to deal with. Some of the other big problems we need to deal with are the fact that we're pulling more water out of our rivers than they can handle. So we have, for example, in California, rivers that run dry before they reach the ocean, which means that the fish and the other species that live in them can't survive. We also have problems with contamination of water. So a lot of people have water in their homes that isn't safe to drink.
I was recently in California and Yuma, Arizona, and that's really the winter leafy green growing area. And I got a good education on the complexity of water rights issues. And when you look at the water rights issues out west, they don't really make common sense. Yet, there's massive economies and a tax base that's built around those. What do you think needs to change to make water rights issues more sensible in the western states?
Yeah, it's a tough question. So, I mean, I think everyone agrees that if you were to develop a system to reasonably allocate water, there's no way that what you would come up with is what happened in over time in California, at least, which is where I'm most familiar with water rights. It's sort of one of those things that it developed and happened, and now we seem to be stuck with it. And there's places like Australia that did completely go back and overhaul their water rights, but they had what they called the millennial drought, a drought that was unprecedented and lasted about a decade. And finally, things got so bad that everybody came to the table willing to overhaul their water rights. And we just don't seem to have reached the situation where that there's that political will to reform water rights out here in the West. But I mean, so some of the big issues with the water rights are that there's senior and junior water right holders. And what that means is that the senior water right holders get everything they need, even in a dry year, before the junior water right, holders are entitled to get anything. Right. So people don't feel the pain equally during dry years.
It's a complex situation.
Yeah. So one of the other big issues with how water rights are set up out here in California is that if you go back and you add up all the rights that people have on paper to water, it comes up to a lot more water than we have. So people talk about paper water. People have rights to water on paper that really they can't get. So people feel entitled to water that the system really can't give them. So it kind of lends itself to a situation that's politically really challenging because people feel like they have a right to a certain amount of water that the system can't give them, at least not on a regular basis. And so you end up almost setting yourself up for conflict.
And I learned a little saying out there that you probably know, that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. So with that situation you've just explained, you could see where that came from. Let's talk a little bit about what's gotten better over time when it comes to water conservation.
Well, things have actually gotten a lot better with water conservation. People's per capita water use keeps coming down over time. Across sectors. So people are using less water in their homes. And then also agriculture is using less water. And that's even as population is going up, right? So we have a bigger population to feed. We have more homes to supply with water, and yet we're using less water overall because per person we're using less water. And it is because we're using water efficiently. It's not that we're growing less food or, you know, not taking showers, hopefully. We're doing all those things, but we're doing them with less water to accomplish the same goals. That said, you know, there's more room for us to keep saving more water. There's lots more technologies, both in people's homes and out in the fields for farmers, that people can be using to accomplish the things we want to do with less water.
What's not getting enough attention out there that really needs to be focused on when it comes to water conservation?
I mean, I think some of the big opportunities are things that that farmers could be doing. So, for example, there's things like deficit irrigation are really useful in the agricultural sector. So there's certain types of crops that actually you get a better fruit if you give the plant less water at certain key times. So for example, grapes, you get a better grape in the end if the plant doesn't get the full amount of water that it could use at certain times during its life. And you can save a lot of water, and you not only get as good a product, you actually get a better product. So there's a lot of examples out there of things that we can do to be smarter with water, where we get just as good or even a better yield in the end.
There's been a lot of talk and a lot of proposed changes at the EPA. How do you see that impacting water conservation?
That's a good question. I mean, so, you know, the EPA is really important both for the data that it generates and also for the regulations that are out there. So, for example, I look to the EPA to get the data that they collect on water quality for the drinking water that's delivered to people's homes. And they've been consistently collecting that data for years, and having, you know, a good quality publicly available data set means that we can answer all sorts of questions like who in the country is receiving water that isn't safe, and what water utilities aren't meeting their meeting expectations about delivering safe water to their customers, and who needs to be held accountable when people are drinking unsafe water. So that type of data is really important. And then also, there's a lot of key regulations that they pass. So, you know, again, the one that I have worked the most closely with is all the regulations around safe drinking water. So the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act all regulate the quality of water, and it affects the water, the quality of the water that we get in our homes, both the regulations and the fact that they enforce those regulations.
We'd like to wrap this up, and we have a few seconds left. What is the biggest misconception about water conservation that you see people still holding on to?
That it's only something to do during the dry years, and that as soon as it rains again, we can just go back to doing things the old ways. You know, we have long-term issues around overusing water in this country, especially in the drier areas out west. You know, so I was saying before, we have rivers that run dry before they reach the ocean. We have populations of salmon that used to be tremendously abundant that are now, you know, hovering on the brink of extinction. We have all these great resources that aren't getting the water that they need because we're being wasteful with it. And the fact is that we've shown during the dry years that we can use less water. And that it's really not that terribly painful. So if we can be more efficient with water, even when it's wet, I think the whole system would benefit.
That's Pacific Institute Senior Research Associate Laura Feinstein joining us on Green Sense. World Water Day is coming up on March 22nd. We'd also remind you to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. The idea of beating swords into plowshares goes back to the Old Testament, where the military becomes farmers. Even though we no longer use swords or plowshares, the idea still works. And here to tell us more is Leora Barish, director of Heroic Food. Welcome, Leora.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you.
Heroic Food helps men and women returning from the military service who can face unemployment, social dislocation, a loss of sense of purpose, and a low self-esteem with careers in sustainable farming, agricultural trades, and food entrepreneurship. That's really a worthy mission and a goal. Where did this idea for Heroic Food come from?
It came from in a number of sources, but primarily from my dad, who was a veteran of three major wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, early Vietnam, and retired eventually was disabled and forced to retire, in fact, retired to Arizona, which was at that time full of orange groves. And he came back from 24 years in war. And what really revived him in a way was these orange groves, the sight of these groves and the smell of the orange blossoms. And he planted a tree in his yard in Arizona, and that was the beginning of a real passion for growing and a real rehabilitation through growing.
And as in the introduction, we mentioned that unemployment and there's other social needs that veterans have. Can you quantify this? How big and great are the numbers in terms of how many vets need this kind of help?
Well, as you know, there are many thousands of veterans returning from these engagements, and the 44, I can't give you numbers, but I can tell you that about 45% of veterans come from rural agricultural backgrounds, and many of them, and some who don't come from such backgrounds, also feel a need for something that they're not getting, and they find it, they find it in farming. I would say it's, I really don't have the numbers of returning veterans off the top of my head, but it's many thousands. If you include older veterans, it's like hundreds of thousands.
But that's an interesting fact that many of these veterans really grew up on a farm or in a rural setting. What made you want to help military vets to give them this understanding of sustainable agricultural skills?
Sustainability, you started out with mentioning from ancient times. This is an ancient idea, plows to swords to plowshares. But, you know, my father would say that he was a chaplain, actually, I should say, and he always said that having to bring forth bread by the sweat of your brow wasn't really a punishment. It was a gift. Because it really taught people a way to integrate and heal themselves and to grow in spirit as well as every other way on many levels. So I grew up loving to farm, partly with my father and also on my own. And sustainability, I started with organic growing, so did he. So sustainability was an important to us in terms of both stewardship, so as a matter of philosophy, possibly religion, and also as a matter of defending the land. Stewardship is defending the land, very literally defending the life and health of the land, the soil, the plants, the animals, all the people who eat food every day, which is everyone. So, and it's a mission, farming. So veterans who need a mission want a just and peaceful mission, and they want a mission that protects the future for their children and all our children. And that's the essence of sustainability.
My guest is Leora Barish, Director of Heroic Food, and we're talking about teaching veterans to farm sustainably. I'm Robert Colangelo. This is Green Sense. What sort of opportunities lie ahead for them? Do you put them in jobs after a certain period of time, or explain how they progress?
Sure. So they do. I'm speaking. So we have two kinds of programs. We have a year-long apprenticeship, which is actually now becoming a two-year apprenticeship, and then a short workshops, which are focused on particular farm topics, like let's say beekeeping or people who want to start, who are already farming or gardening and want to start a new enterprise and learn about that. But the long-term training is the year-long training. So these people will train for a full growing season. That's an 8-month growing season at one of our mentor farms. They will be paid. They're paid apprenticeships. And then during the winter, they learn, they take courses, online courses from Cornell. They take various, they go to conferences and workshops. They go to NOFA conference. They continue to learn. And at the end of that year, we strongly encourage them to continue in apprenticeship, because it takes a long time to learn to farm really viably. But the mentor farms really want these people to stay on. They don't want them to just work 1 year and leave. They want them to stay and become assistant managers and become managers and become farmers of their own.
So they learn their way into a job.
They learn their way into a job, and there's a tremendous need for those people. We have more farmers asking us for veteran apprentices and paid apprentices than we have veterans at this stage. So there is a tremendous need, because this, as I said, it's a mission, and it requires mission-driven people to do it.
Share with us a success story, something you're most proud of.
One of the first people who came to us, named Michael Sandoval, is a Marine veteran, served three tours, and I believe it was in Iraq, and or may not have been three, but served tours in Iraq and was actually injured there, received shrapnel from an IED, thought, what am I going to do now? What can I do now? And he contacted us. He came up to New York to be in our program, which was a great sacrifice weather-wise for him. And he and his girlfriend actually came up, and we got them an apprentice, helped them get an apprenticeship, I should say, at Hawthorne Valley Farm. He worked in vegetable production. He was a vegan himself, and he wanted to work in vegetable production, and did. He took to it so well. The people at the farm said they'd never seen somebody take to it that quickly. And after the end of his first year, which is very little, he was offered a regular paid position as an assistant manager for part of their farm, for the Corner Garden Farm. And that rise, an amazing learning trajectory to go within the first year from a first-year apprentice to assistant management.
That's Leora Barish, director of Heroic Foods, joining us on Green Sense. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Green Sense. If you have any questions or comments or ideas on how to make the world a better place to live, send me an email to robert@greensenseshow.com. We'll be back next week with...
Robert, there's a new game in town, a new name in town, I should say, a domain name. You know, we got .com, .org, .gov, .edu, .tv. I know I'm missing some, but .eco, .eco. Is the new domain name for sustainable businesses, organizations, groups. There you have it. So we'll learn more about .eco.
Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting greensensefarms.com. And you could also view the list of radio stations that are our show. Our goal is to be your honest broker of sustainable information so that you can make informed decisions. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.